You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a bill on the verge of becoming law in California would require companies to treat many contract workers as employees. That would mean big changes for employers, their workers, and maybe consumers. We'll find out more coming up. Now we continue a series on the long-term impacts of the Great Recession. Last week, we looked at the damage the recession did to millennials and the impact it had on politics in the U.S. and across the world. Now we take a look at personal finance and consumer protections. Are consumers today any safer now than they were 10 years ago? And do we pay too much attention to personal finance and not enough to the big picture? Helene Olin joins us now. She's a contributor to the Washington Post Opinions section and the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, and co-author of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Helene, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on again.
Helene, I want to go back to February of 2009 after the financial collapse, unemployment, foreclosures, they're going up. And CNBC commentator Rick Santelli had this big moment speaking from the Wall Street trading floor, talking about an Obama administration mortgage relief plan. Here's a listen.
Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages, or would we like to at least buy cars and buy houses in foreclosure and give them to people that might have a chance to actually prosper down the road and reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water. This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all...
So this popular narrative emerged that the financial collapse was caused by, as he said there, losers who overextended themselves on mortgages and effectively reaped what they sowed. What was your reaction to that line of thinking?
It was so not true. I mean, but it became the dominant narrative after a time, especially as we moved away from the Great Recession and moved, you know, and the economy improved. Over and over again, you began to hear both that people, you know, could take responsibility for their finances and that the financial services sector wasn't responsible for it at all. And then, of course, we got Donald Trump, who has spent, the better part of 2.5 years now rolling back all sorts of consumer protections that were established during the Obama administration.
The whole books have been written about this next question. But in a nutshell, what was happening? What were financial service companies, from mortgage sellers to the big banks to insurers, doing when it came to lending to people who ended up losing out in the Great Recession?
Well, essentially, the brakes came off the system. And basically, loans were given to people who really did not have either the resources to back them up or the ability to pay the rates as they got higher and higher. A lot of deceptive mortgages were sold into the market, but by which I mean people didn't realize the amounts they would be paying would be going up over time. At the same time, of course, that the whole thing was predicated on the fact that what people would often be told is, well, you can refinance, housing prices always go up. There was just simply nobody minding the store. So, of course, when the party ended and everything started to collapse, these people, you know, were in trouble really fast. But what happened was, is first the narrative became not that the banks had been irresponsible marketing these deceptive products, but that people should have been reading these 100-page, single-spaced, small print documents so that they could, you know, they should have understood this, followed by the fact that it was, you know, it was the fault of financial literacy, that they simply weren't responsible enough. And if they had simply been taught how to read a mortgage, they would have been fine. And then the third part, of course, was that the many of the plans enacted by the Obama administration, HAMP and so on, that, you know, so the banks would refinance and help people, actually were not put together very well, with the result that millions upon millions of people ended up losing their homes.
And I want to key in on one point you made there. You've been following the personal finance industry for a long time, and it sounds like some of the advice people were getting going in before the Great Recession was, you're stupid if you're not getting a higher mortgage on your home and investing it and using this money because, as you said, everybody was saying housing prices were going to keep going up, so there was no consequence to it.
One of the less than delightful things about the personal finance industry is that advice is given and then it suddenly changes on a dime. So people will be told, oh, you have to buy a house, right? Houses always go up. Another one that was actually quite common during the period, which gets less attention now also because of the stock market, was that you don't have to save money because if you put money in the stock market, you have savings. Again, not contemplating the fact that the stock market could go down 40% in the matter of a little more than a year.
Talking to Helene Olin, author of the books Pound Foolish and The Index Card, looking at personal finance and consumer protection in the years since the Great Recession. What happened in the personal finance world after the Great Recession? Did it disappear? Did it turn on a dime? What happened next?
It most certainly did not disappear, and it did turn on a dime. What happened was it became somewhat judgmental, rather scolding. And a whole blogosphere of personal finance bloggers grew up. People who sort of told you that you were responsible, you know, for your own fate. And, you know, one by one, you could save yourself. It became very solipsistic, very narrowly focused. And I should say that was one trend within it. And when you hear people say things like, well, you know, you should give up your Starbucks latte or the avocado toast or your iPhone, and then you wouldn't have a problem paying surprise medical bills. You wouldn't have a problem saving for a house. You wouldn't have a problem saving, you know, paying down your student loans. You're getting that strain. Another strain came together as well that gets somewhat less attention unless you're paying attention to politics, which is the Elizabeth Warren strain, which is, as she put, you know, she wrote a book of personal finance in 2005 called All Your Worth. And in it, you know, she talked about how to best protect yourself, but essentially admitted that we really need government to help us. And I'm telling you all this because government isn't helping you. And that has also become an increasing strain within the personal finance and not so much the industry, but among critics of the industry.
And speaking of Elizabeth Warren, she was a champion of what became the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that came into power and into existence, technically, I think, in 2011. Has that made a difference? Has that made consumers safer from risky behavior by banks?
It did for a time. What happened was it came into existence. The first chair of it was Richard Cordray. And when he was in charge, it did things like, you know, go after auto lenders for handing out discriminatory, giving higher interest rates to minorities. It, you know, was very, very aggressive about, you know, helping consumers deal with credit card companies and student loan processors when there were problems. Unfortunately, the Trump administration came into office for the CFPB, and then the CFPB came under the control of people who were actively hostile to it. In fact, when Cordray left, Trump put in for a time his now chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, and Mulvaney had been trying to stop the CFPB for years, was carrying the water of the financial services sector, would call it a sick joke, and then basically came in and tried to make what he said a reality. And so has the chosen successor when finally a person was appointed to the head, Kathy Craninger, where they've rolled back all sorts of protections. Under the Obama administration, the CFPB was trying to put a stop to mandatory arbitration in financial services contracts. That got overruled when it went into the House and Congress voted it down. They were trying to put a stop to abusive student loan practices. They were trying to crack down on all sorts of, you know, malfeasance with the payday loan sector. That got rolled back as well.
And this all came after, even after all the concerns raised in the Great Recession, we had the Wells Fargo fraud scandal that broke in 2016, where they had been signing up customers for other accounts without their knowledge and then charging them for fees on their behalf. Is that a sign that more needed to be done?
It was a huge sign more needed to be done. And that scandal, while, you know, it was being pursued initially out of California, probably would have never received the attention it did without the CFPB taking an interest in it. And one other thing, you know, that was part of the mandatory arbitration issue as well. When consumers signed the paperwork to open an account at Wells Fargo, they signed paperwork saying they would agree to mandatory arbitration in the event of a dispute. And Wells Fargo to this day has held them to that, even for accounts the consumers themselves did not open.
Helene Olin is with us. We're talking about personal finance and consumer protection in the aftermath of the Great Recession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Was there any personal financial advice that helped or hurt you in the run-up or aftermath of the Great Recession? Do you think about money differently now? Do you think there need to be more consumer protections in place in the banking and finance industries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about personal finance and consumer protections since the Great Recession. Helene Olin is with us, contributor to the Washington Post opinion section, author of books including Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes in financial or other regulations that might have helped you during the Great Recession or since then? Did you end up with an unsustainable mortgage? And is there personal financial advice that has helped or hurt you over the years? Call 800-642-1234. Go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess out of full disclosure, I am a financial planner and a CPA, so I understand that I do this for a living. But speaking specifically about the mortgage crisis that occurred, I completely disagree with your guest. If you take out a mortgage and you can't afford it, that is your fault. It doesn't matter that someone was willing to lend you the money. You have an obligation to pay that back. You have an obligation to understand the risks associated with it. To blame the banks is disingenuous. It is the person who took out the loan who's at fault for defaulting, nobody else.
Steve, thanks for the call. Helene?
Well, thank you for making my point, Steve. This is exactly what I'm talking about. These are extremely complicated issuances, these mortgages. It's not like people were given a plain vanilla sheet of one or two pages. There were often hundreds of pages, small print. People were often told things were in the that they were signing and agreeing to things that were simply not in there. They were often not told about conditions that were not in there. And frankly, their ability to reach get help to deal with this was fairly limited. But of course, it's always easier to blame the poor person trying to handle this instead of the institutions that were all but trying to trick people into signing these papers.
Steve, thanks for the call. Go to Dan now in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Howdy. The I don't know if she can go into a detail on she can go into the detail that the banks didn't lose nothing on any of this stuff. The only thing that really lost any money was AIG. They guaranteed or they insured these AAA rated loans. And when the banks didn't get paid, they got paid, though, by the insurance company. So the banks didn't lose no money. So they make money no matter what. So they were dumping off loans off to everybody they could because they knew AIG was going to back them up if they defaulted.
Dan, thanks for the call. And that brings up the idea of the financialization of the mortgages. They were being sold not just for the mortgage themselves, but then to be bundled and packaged into various sorts of derivative products, Helene.
Right. And what eventually happened is, you know, the old joke about, you know, socialism for big business, but not for people. The big banks got bailed out when, you know, these products kind of blew up on them. But again, you know, several million people ended up losing their homes.
Thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jackie with us in Milwaukee. Jackie, hello.
Hi, hello. I'm a realtor, and I was in business during that time, and I do blame the banks. They were selling 80-20, 100% loans, an 80% loan and a 20% loan. They were getting paid for two closing costs. They were making $5,000 to $7,000 per transaction, and I saw them give people loans with a 520 credit score. Horrible. They'd give anybody money at that time. But another big part of the equation in people losing their homes, besides the refinance on that 20% loan that went up to 13, 14%, is that people lost their home, their jobs. They were laying off people like crazy during those days. and nobody could make their mortgage payment. So it really was the consumer who got stuck here.
Jackie, thanks for the call. The double bind, Jackie's saying people were in Helene.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, keep in mind, the other part of this was these mortgages, you know, were given out under the assumption that things would always be good, right? Nobody ever really accounted for what if something goes wrong. And again, people were told this was okay. But also we need to keep in mind that, you know, the savings rate in the country had fallen from about 10% in 1980 to about zero by 2005, 2006. And that was in part because people simply could not keep up with the cost of living. You know, salaries had been stagnant to falling for most people, even as, you know, things like healthcare, housing, education, childcare, and so on went up at rates well beyond that of inflation. And at the same time, they were being told, well, if you put money in the stock market, that won't go down either, which actually is not like the proper response. The stock market should not be short-term savings, and yet people were often told that it was.
Jackie, thanks for that call. We're talking to Helene Olin, contributor to the Washington Post Opinions section, author of books including The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated, talking about personal finance and consumer protection since the Great Recession. Before we go back to our callers, Helene, you wrote a piece in the Washington Post lately. You were at a big personal finance conference. What kind of things did you see there now, 2019?
Well, what I saw was essentially was two things. Is first, this sort of idea that there are these problems out there when people would admit, yes, you know, people are not saving what they need to save for retirement because they can't afford to, or college costs are very hard to keep up with. But then at the same time, the response wasn't to say discuss Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren's student loan forgiveness plans. It wasn't to discuss, you know, Social Security plans to increase Social Security that have been put out by people like Biden, like Sanders, like Warren. Instead, it was to turn around and try to dump the blame on consumers. There was a very self-congratulatory tone to a lot of it. And the other part of it was, of course, was that a huge amount of the conference was devoted to talking to people about, and I mean people, I mean the bloggers and the influencers, about how they could pitch themselves to sort of, you know, get people to use them as consultants, to use them, you know, to come to deals with brands that were at the conference and so on down the line, which, of course, leads you to also wonder, you know, well, in that case, you're probably not going to say the banks, you know, weren't always great players if you're trying to get a deal with a bank, right?
Let's go back to our callers. Bethany is with us in Milwaukee. Bethany, hi.
Hello. Let me just give you a brief synopsis. My daughter, she got accepted to UWM. We agreed, her parents agreed to pay the housing and buy all the books. She was supposed to take out a loan to pay for her tuition. She applied for the loan, and when it was our time to qualify for the loan, we noticed that she was approved for $29,000, even though she needed only $4,200. She has no credit history or anything, yet they agreed, the bank agreed, to give her $29,000, so she should just keep it open just in case she needs more.
Bethany, thanks for the call. Not hearing you super well on the phone line, but she's saying, Helene, bank approved that student loan for way more than applied for. Read that fine print, I guess, and see what you're getting out of this.
I would say one other thing, too. Unless your daughter has maxed out her federal loans already, she should not be going to a bank for a loan. She should be going to the federal government for her loans because the conditions on those loans are much better. So I'm questioning the advice she was given, and I don't know by whom. But this gets to a problem in the entire industry where, again, we're blaming consumers for the fact that they're not really getting good guidance and good advice and that there's nobody really legally responsible in many cases for making sure they're getting the optimal advice and guidance.
Thanks a lot for that call. Helene, I know you're suspicious of the personal finance industry, but given the landscape out there, what kind of personal finance advice would you suggest people look for when they're dealing with things like mortgage and student loans? What can the consumer do short of a big political change?
Well, I mean, one thing you can do is try to seek out a good coach or a good financial planner or you know, who is has a duty to act in your legal best interests. That would be a fiduciary. And that's the exact term you need to ask for, because if you say best interests, that's actually something else. That's one way to do it. But often, frankly, you're on your own. You know, you need to almost know to call a nonprofit debt counselor. Not all debt counselors are created equal. Again, that's very hard to figure out. Debt counselors who are nonprofit are actually quite good at navigating the student loan maze, but you know, it's again, it's on the consumer to almost find that person, which does make it very hard.
Helene, a big part of your work and a lot of what you've talked about today is the idea that the problems in the economy are kind of individualized as opposed to looked at as a big picture social issue. Do you see that tide turning at all over the last 10 years?
I think the answer is yes and no. There's been, there's been on one hand, like the first caller, there's been this, you know, almost, you know, thrust of anger towards people who have gotten, you know, into financial jams in our culture, who have blamed people for not being able to keep up, who have been totally convinced that, you know, people should be able to master these complicated financial schemes that are, by the way, changing all of the time. On the other hand, there's also been a huge movement and a pushback, and you see that really in the presidential election, where, as I said, you have seen proposals for student debt forgiveness, for a push, the fight for 15, which is goes way beyond the presidential election, obviously. You know, things like that have really put the focus on the fact that the economy is not working for huge numbers of people.
We'll leave it there. Helene, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking to Helene Olin. She's a contributor to the Washington Post Opinions section. She's the author of the books Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, and co-author of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. She joins us today to look at personal finance and consumer financial protections in the decades since the bottoming out after the Great Recession. A million contract workers in California may soon get employee status from their employers. That's because of a bill that Governor Gavin Newsom is expected to sign into law anytime now. The plan would rein in businesses' use of independent contractors. That means Uber and Lyft drivers, janitors, construction workers, nail salon workers, and others would automatically become employees and collect pay guarantees and benefits. The law would kick in on January 1st, 2020. Supporters say the move would improve labor conditions for people in the so-called gig economy. Opponents say it'll make doing business more expensive and harm workers who want flexible jobs. Erin Hatton is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University at Buffalo. She specializes in work and labor markets. She got her master's and doctorate, by the way, at UW-Madison. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what's your take, Erin, on the impact of this change in California?
Well, as indicators suggest, it could be huge. There are not only, you know, thousands upon thousands of workers in this kind of new so-called gig economy. There are lots of other workers in other sectors that have been, for quite a while now, effectively misclassified as independent contractors rather than employees, and so have been excluded from all of these different types of employment protections and benefits that comes with the employment relationship.
Right. Uber and Lyft have been the headlines in this story. But can you talk about the rise of the outsourcing, turning somebody who used to be an employee into a contractor?
That's right. This is a new phenomenon. The newness of the gig work is more has to do with the technology involved. But really, this has been going on for quite a long time. Before there was the gig economy, there was the temp economy. And other companies such as, say, FedEx or Microsoft have been using either temps or independent contractors as effectively long-term employees who don't qualify for employment benefits and employment protections. So this isn't new. This has been going on for quite a long time. You know, certainly temp work came around in the 50s and 60s, and the shift this kind of misclassification as independent contractors has really started in the late 1980s and took hold in the 1990s.
What does an employee get that a contractor does not?
Yes, that's a great question. So independent contractors are effectively self-employed. That means they set their own wages, presumably. And as such, as their own, their bosses, because they are self-employed. Therefore, they do not qualify for minimum wages. They do not qualify for overtime. They don't qualify for sick leave, for family leave. And importantly, they don't qualify for the right to unionization. They also have to pay their own payroll taxes. They have to pay their own unemployment insurance taxes. So there are a lot of different kind of protections and benefits that they're excluded from that are have been attached to the employment relationship.
This California law wouldn't make contractors go away. What does the law change when it comes to defining who is a contractor versus who is an employee? What are the standards it sets?
Right. It just simplifies the issue. There have been a lot of tests in place for a long time, which are frankly have been quite complicated and easy to get around. And so it kind of creates a simplified, more streamlined test for determining who is an employee under the law. And who is an independent contractor. So they say, the law says, that an independent contractor must be free from the control of the hiring entity or the employer. They must perform work that's outside the normal scope of business of that employer. And they must be kind of an independent practitioner. You know, imagine someone who goes around from business to business giving their specialized services from time to time, but they do not work at the pleasure under the control of that employer day in and day out.
Talking to Aaron Hatton from the University at Buffalo about a change in law in California, could be coming to other states as well, saying, hey, a lot of people are currently treated as contractors, gig employees. They're really employees, and they need that different status. They'll get better protections and benefits. Now, that second point, that second criteria you just mentioned about it being in their kind of main mission, you have to be outside that main mission if you're a contractor. Uber has already said, well, that's okay. We're exempt from the law because it's our job is a platform for various digital marketplaces. Our drivers aren't really the core mission. Is that going to be a hard case for them to make?
I do think that will be a hard case for them to make. That is a case that they have been making for quite a few years now. But frankly, it just doesn't pass the smell test. Because when we think of Uber, when we use Uber, we think of it as not a business that is providing consumers with technology. No, they are a business that provides consumers with rides. It's a ride service company, a ride sharing company that uses technology to do so. In short, they are in the business of providing rides.
The argument that Uber and many other companies are making is that, okay, you do this, it's going to make stuff more expensive. It's going to raise our costs. Some of the contractors who currently work for us will not work for us anymore because we can't afford them anymore.
Well, that may as well be. I mean, in point of fact, a lot of the social standards of living that we, the system that we have developed in this country has predicated our individual standard of living on employment. Now, we can talk about rearranging that system and decoupling basic standards of living from employment. But in the system that in which we're working, where standards of living are predicated on employment, that also means, and the system that we've developed, is that employers have to help pay for it. So they have to contribute to payroll taxes. They have to pay unemployment insurance. They can't discriminate against workers. They have to recognize unions where they're formed. This law is simply trying to close the loopholes through which employers have kind of gotten around that system, have exploited the loophole to avoid paying their share to workers.
Now, one group that's raised concerns that I hadn't seen until just a little while ago, newspapers in California say, well, hold on, we pay people to write freelance articles. Sometimes we bring back freelancers again and again. This could end up affecting us. Do you see that as a side outcome, or should it apply to these newspapers?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstance. It depends if they pass the test. This test is quite clear, it certainly takes some legal analysis and legal interpretation to determine. But for many journalists, as I understand it, no, I'm not a journalist, but they write articles for a number of different outlets. In that case, as I understand it, they are a true independent contractor. They are kind of selling their wares, their specialty and expertise to different businesses and coming in and providing them on a temporary basis. So, yes, they work within the normal scope, but they are an independent practitioner and do so for several different outlets at their own pleasure, right? They determine their work hours. They determine their pay, I think. Actually, I don't know on that note. But that could be open to legal test.
Now, this is California, and a lot of times California is the first state to change a law, but not the last state. Are you looking for similar things to happen elsewhere in the country?
Oftentimes, you're right. California is kind of a path maker, and I've heard rumors that New York State, where I'm located now, may try to follow suit. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a positive thing. Again, unless we change our social system, which guarantees a basic standard of living for people apart from employment, then I believe that we need to close loopholes through which employers are evading their obligations within the system for all workers.
We're talking about the future of contract work and the gig economy with Erin Hatton. She's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University at Buffalo. Law in California, expected to be signed soon by the governor, would change the status, clarify the laws, and say, hey, a lot of people are now being treated and paid and dealing with payroll taxes as contractors. They're really employees. Effective next year, they would be. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support this effort in California to treat many of these contract workers as employees, or do you worry about its effect on business and or workers? Are you a gig worker? Do you rely on gig workers like Uber and Lyft drivers yourself? What do you think about this? If you're a contractor, would you rather be classified as a contractor or an employee? If you're an employer, same question about who you hire. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a plan in California that would curb businesses' use of independent contractors in many cases. A lot of those workers would be reclassified as employees and granted new job benefits and pay guarantees. This would affect industries such as ride hailing, think Uber and Lyft, but also construction and commercial fishing, just to name a few. Erin Hatton is our guest, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University at Buffalo. She's an expert in work and labor markets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Would you want to see Wisconsin do something similar? Are you now or have you ever been a contract worker or a gig employee? What did you think about it? Would you rather be an employee or a contract worker? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Matt is with us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hi. I have a little bit of a problem with using Uber as an example because I see the future having lots of digital platforms that help to bring people that are providing services to consumers. I mean, in the past, we'd flip out a phone book and you would call people, and there are no more phone books anymore. And so if you're looking to get somewhere and you also, you know, got another guy who wants to help people get there, how far can a digital platform go in connecting those two people before somebody says, wait a minute, you should be an employee, when maybe the contractor says, I want nothing to do with being an employee of Uber. I just want to find people to give rides to. And the same for the other side. I don't really want to do business with Uber other than helping to find a guy. And you could extrapolate that out to many different industries.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. And Erin, that's, of course, the argument from Uber. We're not employing drivers. We're a matchmaking service.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. So one can certainly imagine a company in which that were actually true. So let's say Uber didn't provided the technology not just to connect people to rides, but to all sorts of services. It could be house cleaning, dog walking, rides, book clubs, any sorts of things. So if they were truly focused on the technology as kind of this intermediary between consumer and worker, that would look very, very different. And therefore, we would be talking about those workers in a very different way than this company that uses technology to provide one service. And the service that they're providing to consumers is rides. And so under this new law, that those workers would fall, would become employees rather than true independent contractors.
Matt, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Melissa is on the line now in Merrill. Melissa, hi.
Yeah, I was calling because with the changes in the income taxes, if they're classified as an employee and they pay, let's say, minimum wage, they no longer have to take responsibility for any of the expenses. And as an employee, you can't write off those expenses anymore. So they're going to get taxed in a higher bracket, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas as an independent contractor, they can write off all of those expenses, including, you know, telephone and mileage and, you know, all those things. So how is being an employee better for that person?
Melissa, thanks for the call. Aaron, any thoughts?
Yes, Melissa, that's such a good question. So you're right. It's more complicated than just kind of a plus minus here. Because as an independent contractor, because that means that they're self-employed, they can write off those business expenses. But it also means that they're responsible for all of those expenses. But as employees, at least in theory, the business itself would be responsible for those transportation costs. So it does kind of shift around the liability for these expenses. In general, as I understand it, basic economic analysis show that the worker benefits from being an employee for when they're working for Uber and Lyft than as an independent contractor. Because you're right, they can't write off those expenses, but they are not liable for them and solely responsible for them anymore.
And again, as you mentioned earlier, Aaron, you have to stack against that too the fact that as a contractor, the employee has to pay their own payroll taxes.
That's right. They are, as a contractor, they have other expenses, as well as they don't get minimum wage. Or overtime or those other benefits.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about contract workers, the gig economy, a new law expected to be signed soon in California that would change many contract workers at places like Uber and Lyft, sure, but also a lot of people who have been turned into contractors from being employees in many lines of work. That's expected to happen soon. That would be effective early next year. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Troy is with us in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. I am a worker, but I also used to own a business. And number one thing is, I'm glad they're passing this law because it's really about employers trying to get you to do more for less. It's basically exploiting cheap labor. And it's a race to the bottom. So I'm glad they're coming up with this law. And the second thing is, I want to make a point, is I don't understand why everybody defends these capitalists, these business owners, like when they say, well, then our prices are going to have to go up. I mean, it's common sense that, you know, a lot of these corporations are making like trillions in profits, and them raising their wages or having to pay these contractors more money or whatever it is not going to affect their profits in a margin that they would like everybody to think. So it's not my fault that they choose to drive a Ferrari as opposed to a Cadillac to work. You know what I mean? So I think we need to really start being more pro. Think about the workers, and so, you know, when it comes to what, you know, prices going up, and that these business owners choose to raise their prices so they don't have to cut into their standard of living.
That's Troy. Troy, gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Aaron, your thoughts on what Troy had to say?
Yes, I'm definitely with Troy on this one. One of the narratives that businesses use and have long used to justify this or to argue against this kind of switch is to say, well, workers will lose flexibility. But really, that's not exactly the case. What they really mean is that they'll use the flexibility and the cost saving. They'll lose it, the flexibility and the cost savings. And workers will not necessarily lose any flexibility in this new model. They can still determine their own schedules and work any number of hours a week. That doesn't necessarily affect it. It simply says that the employer cannot exploit these loopholes to avoid their responsibility as employers under the law.
Thanks a lot for the call. Pat joins us next in Birchwood. Pat, hello.
Hi. Maybe I've missed something, but what constitutes an employer? For example, I hire a guy who has his own business putting on roofs. And so for 4 days, I am employing him to put a new roof on my house. So I have to pay all these things and, you know, do what, how, you know, how many hours does somebody have to work for someone for that person to be their employer?
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Aaron, under the law in California, and I think actually under current law, just about anywhere, Pat would not be that roofer's employer, correct?
That's right. That's right. I think there is some variation by state, and I don't know offhand the particulars, but in general, employers are defined by the number of the employers that have to comply with these laws that we're talking about, minimum wage and so on. They have to have a certain number of workers who are working a certain number of hours every year. So having a roofer put a new roof on your house for a couple of days or even a couple of weeks does not make you an employer in that scenario.
Thanks a lot for the call. Time for another caller or two. Jimmy is with us in Mercer. Jimmy, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Jimmy?
I worked up here for three different employers that subcontracted me instead of, you know, I got hired there, you know, and this and that, but then I had to fill out like my own like worksheet and whatever, like I was a subcontractor, which I really wasn't, you know. I was using all their tools and all their stuff, and which is okay. I was glad to have a job, you know. That's the bottom line, is, you know, people are in a pinch to get a job and they can't really, you know, worry about, you know, how they're subcontractors or not. But I ended up having to carry my own insurance too, just in case there was some kind of stipulation, because I really wasn't working for the guy, but I was, you know. And then, you know, when you're doing construction work, you're building a house or something, sometimes there's two weeks or a week or so in between where you're not working. Well, they're off the hook to pay you unemployment and stuff too. So it's kind of unfair, I think. So I think that law should come to Wisconsin, too.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. And Aaron, as I understand it, this could have an impact on construction, at least this California version of the law.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Any industry, and there are quite a few of them, that in which employers kind of regularly avoid this employment relationship, even though they are effectively employees, as Jimmy said, right? He's using their tools. He's working for the guy. But on paper, he's not. He's contracted out, or there's an independent contractor, or, you know, whatever. These are all ways that employers have used to avoid liability for workers, to avoid paying them the proper amount, to avoid paying them unemployment if they get laid off. And these are important loopholes to close.
Thanks a lot for that call. Briefly, as we wrap up, Aaron, this is California, other states thinking about this. Has anybody tackled this at the federal level?
Not as I am aware, but that would look very interesting.
We'll leave it there. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Aaron Hatton, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University at Buffalo. We talked with her about legislation in California expected to be signed soon. It would require companies like Uber and Lyft and many others to reclassify their workers as employees, meaning they'd have to provide them with a minimum wage and unemployment benefits. The bill passed both houses of the legislature there. It's expected to be signed by Governor Gavin Newsom. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, one state says college athletes can receive endorsement money. Others may follow along. We'll tackle the ongoing debate over whether student athletes at the college level should get paid one way or another. Ken Burns has a new documentary out on the history of country music. We'll meet the Wisconsin music historian who played a big role in making it happen. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We've got some lasagna in the oven. A cookbook author tells us how to make classic lasagna, new twists on baked pasta dishes, and some delicious side dishes, too. That, and look at some of the top news stories going on around Wisconsin. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.